Latino Stories, Historias Latinas, es un podcast que nace del proyecto de narrativas orales de latinos en Ohio, Oral Narratives of Latinos in Ohio, con entrevistas en español, inglés, and Spanglish.
Welcome to Latino Stories. I'm Elena Fowles. My guest today is Maria Herrera Sobek. Maria Herrera Sobek was a professor at the UC Irvine and UC Santa Barbara, where she joined the Chicano Studies Department as the Luis Leal Endowed Chair between 1997 and 2009. During her time here, she was appointed Associate Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion from 2002 to 2019 until her retirement in 2019. Herrera Sobek is the author of The Mexican Corrido, A Feminist Analysis, Northward Bound, The Mexican Immigrant Experience, and Ballad and Song, and has edited and co-edited more than 20 books, including Human Rights in the Americas, which was published in 2021. Welcome to the studio in San Antonio, Profesora.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you and to be in Texas.
Profesora, you have spent much of your professional life in California, but yes. Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up here in the Rio Grande Valley in Riondo, Texas, yeah, which was near the border. Right. And we went to Reynosa a lot because my grandparents were from Mexico. I was born in Mexico too, but I came as a baby. Mm-hmm. But they grew up in Zacatecas, actually. Oh, wow. And so they loved Mexico. So anytime we had a chance, we went to Reynosa. That's where all their friends were, and they felt real comfortable. And and they, of course, you know, loved the food. And the border is very Mexican, too. The town, Riondo, Texas, was about 90% Mexican-American, Chicano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So did you grow up in both languages also?
Oh, yes, because my grandparents, they didn't speak a word of English. And they were very chauvinistic and nationalist. They thought Spanish was the best language in the world, and they didn't see any need because, you know, everybody spoke Spanish in the valley. So, the grocery store, the doctor was Mexican-American, when we were in Riondo. But going to school, they didn't have bilingual education or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We were segregated. There were like four rooms of Mexican-American children, which were like four rooms with 30 or 40 students. Mm-hmm. And then there was one Anglo room, which about 20, 25 students. Mm-hmm. And we even had recess at a different hour.
They didn't mix us.
That was so strange. Mm-hmm. I always found it strange. And I found it strange, and I still find it strange, because, you know, so many Chicanos, Latinos, they're blonde and blue-eyed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They're fair skin, they're light skin color, you know, very few. Like when you go to Mexico, to the interior, you see a lot of Indian-looking people. Mm-hmm. I look Indian. And, you know, when I had my ancestry done, it was like 52% indigenous,
right.
You know, not Native American, but indigenous from Mexico. But anyway, so I always wondered, you know, why are they prejudiced against my little playmates? They were blonde, a lot of them.
Right, right. Yeah, so this idea that we all look a certain way, right?
There's fallacy, a spectrum, right? You know, from very dark, Afro-mestizos,
right.
To very light fair, blue-eyed, blonde.
Yeah, güeritas.
Well, we have that term, you know. Right. My brother was blonde. You know, he was my brother. And he was 2 years older than me, and we played. Nobody would believe we were, because, you know, when I am out in the sun, I get very dark, and he got blonder. You know, his hair got, you know.
Lighter, yeah.
So he was güero, you know, and sometimes they would call me prieta. Mm-hmm. So he was a güero, and I was a prieta.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Maria, you have had a long career. What has brought you most joy during this time?
I think my students and making a difference, you know, like Institute in Chicano Studies at UC Irvine, instituting a Chicano PhD in Santa Barbara, working as a vice chancellor, and our university became the first major research university as an HSI. So, you know, those accomplishments gave me, and of course, it's not just me, of course, working with people and getting the chancellor to buy on it, and it's just working. Right. Working and accomplishing, and of course, the students are always
the motivation, right?
I know. I miss them because, you know, I'm retired. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I do a lot of conferences and my research, but I do miss the classroom and being with the students.
Right. So you pioneered a lot of important programs in our, you know, institutions, and which is it's amazing and remarkable because some of those same programs across the states or even topics have seen sort of like a pushback or, you know.
Diversity, you know, the program that actually my university, UC Santa Barbara, really instituted that one position because we worked really hard for it. It was the faculty, mm-hmm. you know, that had wanted to have somebody in the chancellor's office that dealt with the Chicano subject, mm-hmm. you know, in the school and at the university. Yeah. So there was a lot of support mm-hmm. from the students. The students at UC Santa Barbara were very, very political, mm-hmm. extremely so. Right. And so they got a lot accomplished. You know, they had hunger strikes in the 90s before I came. And when I came, I was at UC Irvine, and I was in the Spanish department, which, of course, had a PhD program. So when they recruited me to UC Santa Barbara, I told them I would not go if we didn't institute a PhD program in Chicano studies. It was a first nation, well, research nation, right? A high-level research institution to have a PhD program in Chicano studies. And we were really happy. As a matter of fact, when we inaugurated the program, we invited Dolores Huerta. She was our speaker. She was. She came, and great. We had a big celebration.
Una fiesta vieja, me imagino.
Right, yeah.
And she's still there advocating
so many things. And she's very active. Mm-hmm. She's really active. I keep track of her because she's a very nice person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or she was at the time, you know, that we invited her a lot of times at UC Santa Barbara. So we really liked her, and the students liked her, and so anytime we wanted a speaker, of course, they charge a lot, but the chancellor gave us money. So.
Right. Maria, like I mentioned, you have pioneered many things, and in many ways, right, as a writer, researcher, and international speaker. Talk to us about this journey. What was it like to be one of the first and few Latinas in mm-hmm. academia? And on top of that, like instituting some of these very important programs.
Right. Well, I don't know. Growing up in Texas, I was very a high achiever. Mm-hmm. You know how high achievers are. I wanted to do everything. And my grandparents really supported me. So I think I had very solid background. And then they were very chauvinistic that Mexico was the greatest and Mexican things were the greatest. Mexico was the most beautiful in the world. So I grew up with that very strong person. With my two grandparents. So, but, you know, at UC Irvine, there was resistance to Chicano studies, especially in the Spanish department. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to institute programs, and I did it in Chicano studies at UC Irvine. You know, one of the founders, because that's a new university, was founded in 1965, I believe, UC Irvine. So this was 1975 when I got hired, and I started, you know, really pushing for Chicano studies at UC Irvine, but mm-hmm. it was within the Spanish department. Eventually, they got a department of their own, but I had left for UC Santa Barbara by then. Yeah, I got pushback, but the students, you know, mm-hmm. they've always been so supportive because, you know, it's for them, you know. Mm-hmm. I got my PhD already. It's for them, mm-hmm. you know. But they were really, really gung-ho also. Mm-hmm. So it was always, you know, we would always we were always meeting with the chancellor. We had a dean who was the one that was in charge of the Spanish department, a dean of humanities, and he was from Australia. But he was really, really supportive of Chicano studies and Chicano issues and gave us lots of money.
Right.
So there was, you know, it was, so that's how I just worked really hard with the students and the faculty. It wasn't a one-person thing. I was just lucky that, you know, I had a PhD, I was in the department, and then, the dean liked me a lot, and they were very supportive, the dean and the chancellor also. That's how it started, and that's how it happened.
Right. Tell me about what you saw in the students when this was finally available for them. What kind of things changed, I guess, for the students? And
they loved it, but they wanted more. You know, they kept asking for more things and more, you know. And I think the other part of your question was, you know, how did I get to be worldwide, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, because I got pushback from the chair in the Spanish department. Mm-hmm. I got very upset, and I told him, well, I'll make your department internationally known. So people in Europe were very interested in Chicano studies. Mm-hmm. So this woman from the Sorbonne, she started having conferences at the Sorbonne. Mm-hmm. And oh boy, did that guy, that professor, he was my friend afterwards, but, you know, that the Spanish department was so impressed, you know, France, Paris, and Chicano studies, really? And then, you know, I kept going, then it was Germany, and Germany interested in Chicano studies, and then Spain. Mm-hmm. Spain really is really, now it's at the forefront of Chicano studies in Europe.
Wow.
Spain, yeah. Wow. We're having a conference in June in Chicano Studies at Santiago de Compostela. Okay. And it's every 2 years we have this huge conference.
Okay. I need to go to that. In 2 years I'll go.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this process, right? Because at that time, right, in the 70s, late 70s, when you were doing this work, sadly, some of those departments, right, that sort of put barriers, right?
Or get pushback.
Right, yeah. Or they think, oh, well, this doesn't belong in a Spanish department.
Exactly.
So you were able to do that, right? So this, in my view, still European ideas of what belongs in a Spanish classroom or not. Mm-hmm. We're doing a lot of changes, right, in Spanish programs across the United States,
yeah.
But that's still there, right? This
idea
that maybe Latino studies has to be in its own department, or but not in dialogue or collaboration with both, like they
or Latino like studies, the English department
right,
too,
the English, the Spanish department, right?
Yeah.
It's great to hear that, but it's also a call, I guess, that we need to continue doing this work.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think what happened in Irvine, which is where I started. I graduated from UCLA in 75, and I went to work part time at 50% at UC Irvine, and you know, the students got my job. They told them, the department and the dean, to make me full time, and they had to. They got the position, and of course I was publishing and doing all this and that. So, you know, but it was the students that went to the dean and said, you know, and of course you're not supposed to hire someone. You're supposed to make it a national search.
Right.
And I went through all that, but they did say, the dean said, okay, so he gave the position to the Spanish department. But, yeah, there was a lot of pushback in the English department, too. They didn't have anybody for Chicano literature or anything like that, and Chicano literature, a lot of it is in English.
Right.
But I remember one guy who we were at, one professor who we were at a meeting, and he said, oh, they want to make English department into a ghetto. I mean, to him, a ghetto was insulting, right?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so, you know, it was that attitude from right. some, but then there were others that were very supportive. So that's they great. Were both, you know.
Yeah. And, and it's something to think about, to celebrate, but also to remind ourselves that there's a lot of work that continues.
And that's what happened in the Spanish department. Mm-hmm. It was going down because students were not enrolling in the Spanish mm-hmm. department. Right. You know, it was like their courses, they would have like... 3 or 4, you know, in Spanish peninsular literature, 3 or 4 or 5 students or 15 students. And then I went in there with Chicano literature because I was the only one. Well, no, there was another professor. He mm-hmm. was doing also Chicano literature. He's famous, Alejandro Morales. I don't know if you heard of him. Yeah. He's written a lot of novels. But anyway, we were well together. But they gave us pushback.
The enrollment.
But they were afraid of the students because at that time they would have sittings. They mm-hmm. could come like 30 of them and just take over the office, take mm-hmm. over the chancellor's office, the dean's office. They were afraid of the students.
I feel like we need a little bit more of that student activism.
So you know, when I had courses in Chicano literature, and I had like 40, 50 students. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, compared to somebody having 4 students in right. Don Quixote, which yeah. I'm sorry because I love Don Quixote, but I don't know. The students were really interested in.
Well, in literature and topics that related more to their own experiences,
yeah,
right?
Well, a lot of the Chicanos mm-hmm. would take Chicano literature, right. you know. And so that's how they were able to get positions, you know, in the Spanish department, because the courses would be packed.
Mm-hmm.
They were packed.
And even, like, I imagine not... a lot of our students who are Latino, Chicano, that has, you know, have grown up in the U.S. and are bilingual, have been told that their Spanish is not good enough. And here is a program where it is uplifting those experiences.
Oh,
right?
yeah. I taught Spanish for Chicanos in a couple of universities, and at Irvine, and I taught one of those courses, and they loved it because mm-hmm. I didn't put it down. I spoke like that,
right.
you know. I grew up in Texas, and you know, in the Rio Grande Valley, and I spoke the way my grandparents spoke, and you know, my grandparents were campesinos, you know, from rancheros, actually from Zacatecas, so, and that's near the mountains, near Fresnillo, mm-hmm. anyway. So they spoke in a certain way, but and then I would. That's the Spanish I learned at home. So then I learned it's archaic Spanish. And so you know what? When I read Don Quixote, Cervantes.
You found your language there too.
There it is. So I would tell people that would start kind of like making fun of my Spanish. Well, if it's good enough for Cervantes, it's good enough for me.
That's a great
comment. it was my grandparents that spoke like that, absolutely. You know. And I didn't know like traer, you know, it's truje.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just archaic Spanish.
Right.
That's all it is.
Right.
It's there in Don Quixote. You know?
Variation, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So knowledge is power.
Yes, absolutely.
Knowledge is, they have to know that, you know.
Right, right.
Knowledge is power.
So one of my favorite poetry collections lately is one by that Eddie Vega put together. And it's called Asina.
That's right? My grandmother said Asina.
Right.
And I did
so
too, I guess, you know.
It's part of that, right, archaic
Spanish. It
Spanish,
is.
Spanish, right,
it is.
That we found in old Spanish.
1600s, 1500s, yeah.
Right. Maria, were you one of the first or the only ones in your family to go through, you know, the university to grad school to have a PhD?
I was the first, but my brother, who was older, but he started the same as me. He got a master's. Now I have my niece. She had a law degree. She's now retired, but she had a law degree. But I was the first, yes.
Right. And what drove you to that? Like, you didn't have anybody in your family. Like, how did you keep going? What motivated you?
Even though my grandfather, he was my step-grandfather. He was mm-hmm. not my biological, but he was illiterate. He didn't know how to read and write, and he had to learn how to write his name to get his green card. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a bracero in the 40s, you know, but he didn't know how to read or write. And my grandmother did, because she had an aunt that taught her, but barely, right? Barely. Right. She could read all kinds of oraciones, Catholic books.
Prayer books. Yeah.
Prayer books. I would see her reading those. And since I was a little girl, since forever, I loved reading, I loved learning, I loved languages. I just had a really, inside of me, I had this love for learning.
Right.
Wow. I love learning, yeah. I have a degree in chemistry and minor in the biological sciences. I had a master's in Latin American studies because I love traveling and the world. And then my PhD was in Hispanic languages and literatures from UCLA. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just loved learning. I really did. It was just innate. I mean, my grandmother, she just knew so much. She didn't go, had formal training, but, you know, talking about in the panel this morning about fairy tales and stories, and she had real stories because she was a little, well, she was born in 1895, so she was during the revolution, Mexican Revolution, 1910, 1917. She was in Zacatecas, and she had all kinds of stories. She met Pancho Villa as a little girl. I know, and she had a story about him. And I know, and she was like very, very strong. She was chaparrita. Mm-hmm. She was really short, but very, very strong-willed and strong-minded. And I think I got it from her in a way. Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Before I go to the following question, I wanted to ask you, did you, in the spaces that you occupied in higher ed, were you able to also mentor a lot of Latina students through their own journeys?
Yeah, because we had the PhD program. But the students choose the professors. Right. And so I always had different students that wanted me to be chair of the dissertation. Uh-huh. But by that time, I became a vice chancellor, associate vice chancellor, I think it was 2002 or something, so a long time ago, 2001 or 2002 until I retired. Mm-hmm. The chancellor didn't want me to retire. He kept saying, do one more year. But anyway, I was very much involved. Also, I was involved with a group, with an organization of Chicano Studies that they had there. They were very strong, as I said, because they had the hunger strikes, and they were very powerful and very strong and very nice young people, very committed, very, very committed. Mm-hmm. So they were great to work with, yeah.
So you're now visiting San Antonio for the Borderlands Shakespeare Conference, and your talk, which we'll hear later today, focuses on corridos and Shakespeare. How do you see these two seemingly opposite genres working?
Well, I think I read Shakespeare for the first time in high school. I was remembering, but I was a big reader, but I hadn't read Shakespeare until they taught it in our English teacher. I went to a very tiny high school in Gilbert, Arizona. But I love, as I was telling you, I just love literature. I read everything I could, I went to the local library, which, because it was a small town, it was very tiny, so I read everything they had. I loved it, in a way, to me, as a matter of fact, I was thinking about it. I said, I think I got colonized because I felt very English. I read all the classics from England, not even American, from England. They just had them there in the little library, town library, which was like a room like this, right? It was funny the way I think about it because, I wanted to go to England and, I read Charles Dickens, all his books, and, I was like, and there's the street. With Shakespeare, we got introduced in the 10th grade, I think we read Hamlet. And I loved it. You know, I just thought it was great. And then in the 11th grade, we read Julius Caesar. And I liked that too, but I loved Hamlet. I mean, that's still one of my favorites, you know. I think the other favorite, but it wasn't Shakespeare, it was The Diary of Anne Frank, which, you know, like Hamlet, I was thinking when they ask you which two works have influenced you the most, I think The Diary of Anne Frank, and because of the immigration issue and and trying to understand prejudice, you know, they were killing people. I found out I have 1% Jewish in me. I didn't know. I did that ancestry. I think I have a little bit, 1% of everything, you know. Yeah, I do. It's strange. But Zacatecas was a mining town. So a lot of foreigners came there, you know, engineers. And it was the second largest silver mine in the world. The first one was in Bolivia, in the silver mines in Bolivia. But Zacatecas was the second. And I think that's why I have French, 2% French.
Arabic, probably.
Iranian, Persian. Yeah. They call it Persian because, you know, Irene is a new name, right?
Right.
Persian. So I think I may be related to Alexander the Great. I'm kidding. But, you know, I'm 1% and Scottish, 1%. And Basque, I'm 6% Basque. And Portuguese, 7%. And, of course, Spanish from Spain, 29%. So I'm kind of like European, like 48 and like 52 indigenous, I think, something like that.
And so where were you interested in like the corrido form and Shakespeare? How did you merge those? How did you study that?
The corridos, I grew up with them because of the border. Right. And my grandfather, you know, he had a radio, and he was always putting it in the Mexican radio stations, which in the border, because it's Reynosa's right there in Riondo. Right. So he would get all. And so the corridos were very fun. And then my grandmother, that's the one, she used to sing corridos as lullabies for me. So I love them. And so when I was invited by Adriana to do this conference, it was a challenge, you know. I thought, well, I know Shakespeare deals with the human experience, and that's what I think, the human experience. Mm-hmm. And corridos deal with the human experience. Mm-hmm. They're very positive about their culture, like the corrido is very Mexican, you know, and Shakespeare is very English, but they both criticize, you know, Shakespeare criticized the hegemonic, the power structures, right? Mm-hmm. Well, even in Romeo and Juliet, for instance, the criticism is the hatred between those two families. And then that deals to the tragedy. And you know, some of the other ones, the same thing. Right. It deals to the...
egos.
But, you know, it can happen. I was thinking that can happen when I was a little girl, you know, like if somebody was going from a different family, and no, they couldn't date them, or they couldn't go out, they couldn't marry them. And sometimes they eloped, you know, se la robó. Because they wouldn't let them get married.
Right.
And it was just, you know, regular Mexicanos, right? Mexican people from Mexico. I'm talking about the Mexican people. And so, and then the tragedies, jealousy, like Othello, you know, there's a whole bunch of corridos that killed the girlfriend, usually the woman. You know, the Mexican corrido, a feminist analysis, I deal with a woman in the corrido. So I thought, well, there are a lot of tragedies that, you know, because the like Rosita Alvarez, I don't know if you know anything about corridos, but Rosita Alvarez, the guy asks her, they are at a dance, and he goes out to ask her to dance, and she says no, and he says, don't turn me down, the people are going to notice, I'm going to be embarrassed to death, and she says, I don't care, I don't want to dance with you, and I'm not going to dance with you. So he gets his gun and shoots her 3 times, and then the ending said, no más tres tiros le dio. I'm going to talk about that this afternoon, but you know, the people who listen, they laugh, and they say, well, how many more did he want to give?
Right. You know? Was 3 not enough?
Yeah, I know. So you know, there's different kinds where the male kills the woman, the tragic event, you know, tragedy, like in Othello, he kills the woman, even though she was innocent.
Right.
So, that's how I thought, there's lots to work
with. Absolutely. And I was thinking about our presenter earlier today, right? La maestra de middle school, and how she reads, pieces of the play, and then has the students write a corrido about it, and so they follow sort of like a similar structure, right? And
I'm gonna be I'm gonna give the structure too, and I even wrote a corrido on Adriana at the conference.
That's great.
There's thousands of corridos on every topic you can imagine. That's the point, and it deals with a human experience, all kinds of human experiences. So I wanted to tell the audience today that the reason there's so many corridos is because it's very easy to write them. People might think, write a corrido. But the teacher today was saying that she teaches her students. And it's formulaic. The word is formula. There are formulas to it, and you have a structure, and you can do a corrido, and then I do a corrido just to show the audience that it can be done, and it's not something, out of the ordinary.
Right. The corridos that I'm most familiar with is the ones where the singer is talking about some sort of injustice. So el corrido, el más famoso, ¿no?, de Gregorio Cortez.
Oh, yeah,
and things
definitely.
Like that. So there is, like you said, there's different types of corridos.
That's resistance, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And it's confirmation because the people support what he did, Their corrido is still around.
Right. It ties to also the history of the experiences of Mexicanos, right?
The sheriff shot his brother, and then he came over, and probably Cortez thought he was going to shoot him too, so he shoots him first.
Right, absolutely. Professora, you are retired, but you're not at home just reading, although you love to read.
Yeah, I do.
So you're actively participating in academic life, and I think I saw you at the American Folklore Studies.
Were you there?
Yes, I was there.
They were celebrating Norma, Cantu, and they invited me. So I went there, and they were.
You're not really slowing down. That's what I'm saying. Maria, are you working on any writing right now or projects at the moment?
I'm working on a whole bunch of them. I'm working on a book right now with two other colleagues. We're co-editing a book about Chicanos, and this is for a Mexican audience. Mm-hmm. So it's in Spanish, and so we gather articles that were either in Spanish or English about Chicanos. But this, it's going to be published by the Fondo de Cultura Económica in Mexico City, and we have the final stages, it's almost done. Some of the articles had to be translated because it's all in Spanish, right? So I'm working on that, and then I'm working on a book on with Santa Barraza. Do you know her? Santa Barraza? Oh, she's a fabulous. She's from Kingsville. She's from here. She has fabulous paintings, and so she, and then Modesta Treviño is the wife of an artist. Jose Francisco Treviño, he's from Austin. He passed away. Mm-hmm. So she wanted a book written on his work, and she had seen, with Santa Barraza, I edited a book on Santa, and it's a beautiful book. I think they're selling for $100 now. And they're used, she was telling me that. Anyway, so I'm working on Jose Francisco Treviño. He's from Austin. He's a Tejano, and so we're writing a book, editing a book, because people
are contributing.
We already have all the contributors, and I got one of them already wrote her article. So that's two books that I'm, and then a third one is I want to get back to my, I wrote on, I already had the manuscript almost completed, and it's on La Malinche, the Virgen de Guadalupe, and La Llorona.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah, great. So I need to get back to that and to finish it up and, and you know, then hopefully get it published. So
what else are you doing to enjoy retirement?
Well, yeah, it seems like I should have more time, but but I'm traveling. You know, I went to Chile, as I was saying, and I enjoyed that a lot because I hadn't been there, and it was, you know, fun seeing.
And then you're going this summer to
I'm going to France.
In France?
And, yeah, France for, it's the ballet, it's the international, it's a, you know, it's a international ballet conference that is done every year. And this time it's near Paris, Vitre, V-I-T-R-E, France. It's a small town near Paris. So it's a conference there. And it's held every year in really wonderful places. You know, I was in the Czech Republic a few years ago, and it was in Finland last year, I think, and I couldn't go I don't know why, but I couldn't go. Anyway, it's held in all these beautiful countries and, you know, beautiful places, too.
Yeah. So you get to travel a lot.
I get to travel a lot, yeah. I was in Siberia, too, but it was not the corrido. It was in bilingual education, because they have bilingual education with Asian Russians. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anyway, there was a conference there, and we were speakers there, and it was fun.
Well, I like your retirement schedule, so something to look forward to.
Well, I have more time to write.
I know, more time to write, which I hear that often. Profesora, muchas gracias por esta conversación.
Oh, gracias. It was a pleasure. Ha sido un placer estar aquí contigo.